This time next week, Mitz Hashem, Kulanu Mesubim. In the meanwhile, there's plenty of work to be done, not only in the house, but also Babayis Uvasode, the field of learning. And I would like to devote our remarks this evening to Magid and to the central pillars of Magid, if we may call them that. Of course, the Haggadah spans many pages, but Chazal in the Mishnah already identify certain key fundamentals that make up the backbone of Magid, and from there it will expand B'chol Hamarbe Harezeh Meshubach. And the first item that I would like to examine this evening is the vector of Magid. That is to say, the Mishnah tells us in Arvei Psochim, of course, at the end of Maseches Psochim, it gives us a directive in terms of how to tell the story with the words Maschilin Bignus Umesaimin Bashevach. It is incumbent upon us for the full story to begin with the negative, Maschilin Bignus, to begin with the difficulties, Umesaimin Bashevach, and to conclude with the positive. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh comments that this idea is actually alluded to in the Torah, this notion that we begin with difficult times and from there move towards the happier times. For in the Pasuk, which represents the source of the special mitzvah of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on Seder night, which is a mitzvah min ha-Torah, on Seder night we have many mitzvahs. Two of them are mitzvahs min ha-Torah, Kazayas of Matzah, of course, and the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. It is not, quote-unquote, merely the story that accompanies the mitzvahs of the evening. It is one of the primary mitzvahs itself. And every mitzvah has a source. And the source of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, as we know, is the pasuk, V'igadeto levincha bayomahu leimor, ba'avruzeh asa Hashem li betzeisi mimitayim. It's a mitzvah to tell over. And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh points out that we have two verbs as the Pasuk introduces the mitzvah. V'higadata levincha bayomahu leimor. And the word Haggadah, as opposed to Amira, have different connotations, as we've mentioned many times, as expressed in Rashi and Parshas Yisro, Kotomar lebeis Yaakov, V'saged levnei Yisrael. The word Haggadah has a connotation of difficulty. Koshim kigidim, tough like sinews. And amira, by contrast, is amira raka. It's something that is mild and pleasant. And interestingly, they're both to be found in this pasuk in a very specific order. Namely, vihigadata, the mitzvah begins with difficult things. Koshim kigidim, that's maschilim bignus. We begin with the difficulties. But vihigadata levincha, the point is to begin with those difficult experiences, leimor, with a view to then reaching the Amira Raka, the more pleasant aspects, Mesaimim Bashevach. And the question that Mefarshim ask is, why should it be so? After all, we always have an eye on economy. The Tachlis is the Shevach, that we're free and we left Mitzrayim. Why is it important to focus on Maschilim Bignus? It seems like between the two of them, they work as a team. And the Maharal explains in the Sefer Gevuras Hashem that the answer to this question is embedded in the fundamental nature of the mitzvah of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Should we ask the question, why do we tell the story? What are we looking to gain from telling the story? Oftentimes, a story is told in order to inform. The information is not the basis of Seder night. It's not about knowing more. It's not about finding out more pieces of the story. Leila Seder, says Maharal, is not a night of information. It's a night of appreciation. The focus and the goal is to emerge with an appreciation of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Says Maharal, human nature, being what it is, awareness and appreciation do not always go hand in hand. One may be aware of many things, but one only appreciates them when they are contrasted with their absence or counterpart. A person may have money. Does he appreciate his money? No, not always. When are the typical times that he would appreciate it? Well, number one, the day he comes into money. Or number two, a day that he almost lost his money. It's always weighing up the presence with its potential absence. That's what breeds appreciation. And therefore, says Maral, if we just, as we do every day and night of the year, we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it's important to remember it and be aware of it, but one could say we are no freer on Seder night than we are the night before or the night after. But what happens on Seder night is we go back to Golas Mitzrayim, Maschilim Bignus, in order to appreciate the Yetzias Mitzrayim, because Seder night, above all, is a night of appreciation, as the Rambam, even in his codification of the mitzvah, in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, before he discusses at length the halachas in the Mishnah Torah, but in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, the Rambam says that the mitzvah is of Sipur and of Hoda'ah, of thanksgiving. One has to tell the story in a way that leads one to feelings of appreciation, and that one can only really appreciate the Shevach if one begins with the Gnus. And thus we have our first component of the special mitzvah of Magid. However, the question still needs to be raised. Well, I wouldn't say needs to be raised, but it was raised, which means now we know it needed to be raised. What is the Gnus? What is the Shevach? We may feel we have a pretty good idea, knowing a thing or two about Seder night, but we'll be interested to find out that it's actually a machlokas in the Talmud, between two of the great Amoraim, Rav and Shmuel. What is the Gnus? What is the Shevach? Asked the Gemara in Maseches Psachim, Kuftet Zayin. Rav says, well, if we begin with Shmuel, because it's the more intuitive for us, the answer is right in front of us. The difficult times are Avodim Hayinu Lefara B'Mitzrayim. The positive times are Vayotzieinu Hashem Elokeinu Misham. It's that vector from slavery to freedom. That's what it's all about. There's your Gnus, and there's your Shevach. Nothing more needs to be said. According to Rav, however, no. The Gnus and the Shevach are not about being slaves in Mitzrayim. They're not about leaving Mitzrayim. They're something else. For Rav, what is the Gnus? Mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu. Originally, we were rooted in avodah zarah, Va'achshav kervono hamokom lavodoso, but then subsequently Hashem brought us closer to his avoda, and that is the Shevach. That's quite a different answer to this question. Now, we note, of course, before we examine the machlokas, we can't help but know that we say both of them. And we do. We say plenty more. But we will say Avodim Hayinu, and we will say Mitchile Ovda Vodazari Havoseinu. What does that say about how we relate to these two opinions? And ultimately, that question will be impacted by the pre-question, which is, how do these two opinions relate to each other? What does Rav think about Shmuel's explanation? What does Shmuel think about Rav's explanation? And as is often the case when it comes to a machlokas, who do we paskin like? Rav and Shmuel will argue throughout the Talmud, and we have to rule. Do we rule on Seder night? And if so, according to whom? And then why do we say both of them? And with regards to assessing this very fundamental machlokas, we will find that there are different approaches amongst the Rishonim. The Avudram, in his Perush on the Haggadah, so he takes what is arguably the simplest approach, namely, number one, in understanding the shape of this machlokas, it is a machlokas. That is to say, Rav says the Gnus and Shevach are about Avodah Zarah and Avodah Hashem, not Avodah Mayinu. Shmuel says it's about Avodah Mayinu, not Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah. It's an exclusive machlokas, whereby each side says this is what it is and not what the other one says, as machloksim normally are. If that's true, then something unusual happens as we come to our practice, because we say both. When we say both, what that represents is that we are not paskening here. That is to say, whereas in many other cases, you're either chayiv or potter, it's either osur or mutter, but when it comes to this particular machlokus, as far as Rav is concerned, it is this way and not that way, and for Shmuel, it's that way and not this way, but we have the luxury, seeing as no one's really going anywhere, to do both, which we do. We begin with Shmuel, Avodah Mayinu, and in the fullness of time, we come over to Rav, Mitchila, Ovda Avodah Zarah. So the machlokus is a classic machlokus. What's a departure from the classic response is that we refrain from actually ruling like one at the expense of the other. Rather, we say, Kol Dichvin, Yesev, Yechol, let them all come in, and we'll say both of them. Interestingly, another of the Rishonim, the Ritva, understands that the reason why we say both of them is because the very machlokus between Rav and Shmuel is not which one to say, but rather in which order to say them. As if to say, for the Ritva, it is an inclusive machlokus. Everyone agrees that by the time the fourth cup is drunk, you will have said both of these things. You will have said Avada Mayinu, and you will have said Mitchila Ovda Avodah Zarah. The question of that is disputed and debated between Rav and Shmuel is, where do you start? What's the point of departure of the story? And interestingly, there are two ways to look at it. For Rav, you begin with Mitchila Ovda Avodah Zarah, and why do we start with that? Because chronologically, it's first. We refer back to Terach, Avi Avram, Avi Nachor, and therefore we begin the story at the beginning, and then as things go on, we come to Avodah Hayinu. So for Rav, the chronological order is what dictates play. Shmuel, however, understands that the order here is determined not by chronology, but rather by the relevance, shall we say, the immediacy of the relevance of these events to Seder night. At the center of everything is Avodah Hayinu. It is the immediate response. Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zorah and Achshav Kervonu Hamokam Lavodoso is the broader response. And therefore, often it is the case that the question that needs to be answered first is not the question that was asked first. It's not the first event, but rather it's the most immediate event that needs to be discussed, and around that we come to Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zorah. So, to recap, according to the Ritva, Rav and Shmuel agree with each other that both are to be said. Their machlokas is which order is to say them. And if that's true, then of course we can't say both of them at once. We do choose a specific order. It will emerge that the order that we choose is the order of Shmuel, because Shmuel is the one who said that when you say both of them, you will say Avodah Hayinu first, because that's the immediate response. And then you will come to the broader response of Mitchila, and that is how we do it, and therefore, indeed, we are paskant within that way of understanding the machlokas. It seems that there isn't really another way to understand what it is that we do, and yet we will find a third approach, which will open up a great deal of magid for us in the writings of the Abarbanel. And the reason why is because if we remind ourselves of a little bit of the Seder of the Seder, first is Manishtana, immediately after Manishtana comes Avodah Hayinu, and then there's a few other things, a little bit further down the line is Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zarah. And the Abarbanel has comments appended to both of those sections, Avodah Hayinu and Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zarah Hayoveseinu. When it comes to Avodah Hayinu, says the Abarbanel, this is the answer to Manishtana. That's it. When it comes to, later on, Mitchila Ovde Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu, says Abarbanel, now we begin Bignus U'Mesayim B'Shevach. Which is very interesting, because actually, according to some, that's already happened. We already did that with Avodah Hayinu. We started with the difficulties of Avodah Hayinu, then ended up with the positive of Ayotzeinu, and the Abarbanel did not reference the concept of Maschilim Bignus U'Mesayim B'Shevach. He said, this is the answer to Manishtana. Somebody asked, this is the answer. Pretty soon we'll go down to business of Matchilim Bignus, which happens the second time round. What exactly does the Abarbanel mean when he says that Avodah Mayinu is the answer to Manishtana? That's a very interesting question. And the reason why is because if we pay attention, we may notice that if of the four questions that are asked, not all four are answered. Certainly not immediately. As if to say, if the question is, why do we eat matzah? Good question. Why do we eat maror? Another good question. How can we dip twice? Further good question. Why are we leaning? Four good questions. What's the answer to any of that? Well, apparently the answer to everything is Avodah Mayinu Lefar B'Mitzrayim V'Yotzeinu. It's a very important part of the story. It is the fulcrum of the story. But should you say, okay, but why matzah? Don't know. And, you know, why? In other words, it's true that expositions of matzah and maror will come later. Matzah zoshanu oklum, al shumma, which is a good question. It's actually the question that the child asked about 3 hours ago. And maror zeshanu oklum, al shumma, it's another good question. So this child is asleep already. And by the time somebody asks questions, and some of the questions, it seems, go unanswered until further notice. Why do we dip twice? No one ever talks about that. There's no point in the Seder where we say, and that's why we dip twice. Okay. The child is so busy being congratulated for saying Manishtana, he may fail to notice whether anyone's actually answered his questions. What's also interesting is, and for me, these were stunning points within the Abarbanel's writings. I was literally stunned. Because Manishtana is all about the child. He notices all the things that are unusual. And it's true. We do many things on Seder night that are unusual in order to pique the curiosity of the child and to get him to ask. In certain households, it's harder for the child to notice something unusual. Okay, each one according to whatever constitutes normalcy and the departure therefrom. However, there are certain unusual features of the evening that are not in the Manishtana. And that itself is unusual. For example, if we would, in our own spontaneous list of unique features of the evening, at a certain point we would talk about Arba Kosos. That's unusual, or should be. And therefore, the child he's asking about matzah and maror, everything, Arba Kosos, doesn't seem to set off any flags for him. Now you could say, balabatishly, that perhaps the reason why he doesn't ask about Arba Kosos is because he doesn't know there are Arba Kosos. As if to say, everything else is in front of you. The matzah is there. The maror is there. But when we talk about Arba Kosos, of course, we can't get caught up in the literacy of what we mean. There's only one cup. It happens to be that it will be filled four times. Quite true. But he doesn't see four cups in front of each person that he could say, well, why are there four cups? What we call the four cups is a euphemism for one cup four times. But maybe he doesn't know. And that's an interesting question. Do we intuit that the son can already guess what's about to happen? Presumably not. And maybe that's why he doesn't ask, because he doesn't see four cups. But that's not enough. And the reason why is because even if the son doesn't know that there's going to be four cups of wine drunk, he has already seen more than the norm. Because the norm is Kiddush and then Hamotzi. We've already had Kiddush, and immediately before Manishtana, it is the introduction to Manishtana. Mosgin Kos Sheni, we pour the cup a second time. That should already be enough. And even if he doesn't know that there's going to be number three and four, but Ala Rishonu on him with Starin, he should already be asking, why did you fill up the cup a second time? So that's very interesting, because his questions are quite broad. They encompass all the aspects of the evening, but they ignore what has happened just now. 10 seconds before Manishtana, the cup has been filled again, and the son makes like he never didn't see a thing. That's interesting. Why are the four cups missing from the Manishtana? Moreover, there is something else that happens, which, at the way that it's described in the Gemara, which would be much more impactful than what we have, but nonetheless, the Mishnah says, "Misalken es hakaara." We take the food away. Now, originally, they would take the whole table away because each one had their small tables in front of them. They would take it away. Why? In order to induce the child to ask. What happened to supper? We didn't even start yet and we're clearing up. Which is a good question. For us, we remove the Seder plate. Or some cover the matzahs or do something. But in the original, the food was taken away. Why? So that the child should ask. That precipitates manishtana. Those two things. The food is taken away, so they ask manishtana. What an unusual night. What have you noticed? Well, there's matzah here and there's mora. Did you notice anything else? No. Did you notice that we just took all the food away? Apparently not. But that was done specifically in order to get the child to ask. And he asked about everything except for that. These are intriguing questions. There's four questions in the Manishtana. But there's so many other things, specifically these other things, the Arbakosos, and they're not there in the Manishtana, and our question, of course, is Manishtana, right? What's different about those other changes that they're not in the Manishtana? And all of this leads the Abravanel to conclude that the question of Manishtana, which we colloquially, by the way, call the four kashas or the four questions, they're not four questions. They are actually one question. It is a composite question that it's made up of four parts. And the question very simply is, there are evenings in the course of the Jewish year where we celebrate happy things. There are other evenings where we commemorate less happy things. But we never do them together. The confusion of the questioner here is that he has conflicting messages, conflicting signals. He sees in front of him things, on the one hand, things that seem to have a connotation of celebration. You've got your mesubim, which is classic, in recline. It's a celebratory meal. On the other hand, you've got maror, which is, it is the nth degree removed from reclining. I mean, what type of evening is it? And you've got the matzah. Until he knows further about the matzah, it doesn't look very impressive. It doesn't look as like freshly baked bread that he's used to. But then you have the matbilin shnei pa'amim, like we're dipping as if we've got all the time in the world, and another appetizer. And in a sense, therefore, the question of the one who asked the question is manishtana, like what an unusual night, because it has these contradictions in it. It has messages on the one hand of freedom and on the other hand of the lack thereof, and which is it? That is why, says Abarbanel, and it's quite a statement, the other unusual things, they're not in the Manishtana, because Manishtana isn't about unusual per se. It's about contradictions. And therefore, the component parts of the Manishtana will be things that represent affliction and things that represent celebration. But things that are stam unusual, I mean, they may induce the child to ask, but they're not going to be put on his list of contradictions in Manishtana. Because taking the food away is stam strange. And it induces him to ask, but it's not going to be one of the things that he's asking about. And moreover, says Abarbanel, Ba'amevin Yovin, drinking four cups of wine is not unequivocally one or the other. It's difficult to put it on the list because it doesn't necessarily represent celebration. People actually drink four cups of wine for one of two reasons, and they may be opposing reasons. It could be in celebration, possibly. But people also drink wine when they're not celebrating. They may drink wine for the opposite reason. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Tenu Shechar Le'oved V'yayin Lamare Leva. If a person is brokenhearted, so give him a drink. That's what it says in Mishlei. And therefore, says Abarbanel, because the child cannot identify per se if we're having another cup and another cup, it could mean a couple of things. It could either mean everything's fantastic, or it could mean, right, it could be that we're on top of the world, or maybe the world is on top of us. We don't know. So he leaves it out. And given that that is the nature of the question, comprised of four parts, says Abarbanel, so the answer, the short answer to that question, it is one question and it is answered on the spot. If the question is, why do we seem to be commemorating two conflicting things? The answer is because two conflicting things happened. On the one hand, Avadim Ayinu, and remembering that. And on the other hand, Vayotzi Einu, today, And therefore, we're remembering that. That is why we have all of these types of messages. And thus, the Abarbanel sees within Avodah Mayinu not so much a discourse of the story, but rather an answer, a comprehensive answer to the question of Manishtan. I should mention that the difficulty that may arise with the explanation of the Abarbanel, and that is that he himself raises another question. Namely, why is it that the child doesn't ask about another unusual facet of the evening, that the meat is roasted specifically and cannot be prepared in any other way? And to that, the Abarbanel says, because once again, that doesn't necessarily mean freedom or misery. It means roasted. I mean, there are reasons for it, but it doesn't smack of either atmosphere, and for the same reason that the four cups are not on the list, and for the same reason that every other thing that is only unusual is not on the list. So roasted meat is also not on the list. The problem, of course, is, and the Abarbanel is doubtless well aware, that in the Mishnah, in Arei Psachim, which has the original text of Manishtana, roasted meat was on the list. Shebechol ha'leilos, on all nights, anu ochlim basar tzali, shaluk u'mevushal, we can have meat that's roasted or cooked, ha'layla hazek, kulo tzali. And therefore the simple reason why that question is not in the Manishtana is it's not in the Manishtana anymore, because that is not part of the Seder anymore, until further notice, until we have the Korban Pesach again. But in principle, it is on the list. But that would seem to raise a question mark on the approach of the Abarbanel, because given that in his own words it doesn't seem to indicate not chayrus or its opposite per se, but is merely unusual, it shouldn't have been on the list, but it is on the original list. At any event, for the Abarbanel, that is what Avodah Mayinu is. But should you say, is this a fulfillment of Maschilin Mignus? As far as the Barbel is concerned, not at all. We haven't even started yet. We haven't started telling the story. The question has been asked. We've given a comprehensive answer, and soon we will begin. And that is why, when it comes to the paragraph of Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah, says the Barbel, and now we get to Maschilin Bignus Umesaimin Bashevach. So, to understand very clearly what the Barbel is saying, we do say both. But we say both Avodah Mayinu and Mitchila, not because we are reluctant to come down on either side. No, we say both, but not in the same capacity. And when it comes to Mitchila Mignus and Mesayim Bashevach, we come down decidedly on the side of Rav, who said it's Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah, Hayu Avosenu. So here we have before us three approaches to this machlokas, and that's an important word of preface for appreciating this central pillar of Magid Maschilin Bignus and Mesayim Bashevach. I would add, perhaps, I haven't seen anyone speak about this explicitly, but the fact seems to remain that of the two opinions, Shmuel's one is the most, at least most immediately true, or most immediately relevant. It's Seder night, after all. The broader context of originally we were idol worshippers and then Achshav Kevana Amokam Lavodoso, that's much broader than Seder night. It's much broader even than Yitzias Mitzrayim. It began way before, it ended up way afterwards. It's true that our experiences in Mitzrayim are somehow in the center of that and very much, very, very influential in terms of that whole process. But how does Rav know that the story on Seder night is to embrace the entire process, beginning so much earlier and ending significantly later? And I think perhaps, without oversimplifying, the answer may be right in front of us. Because if we go back to the Pasuk, which is the proof text for the mitzvah of telling the story, V'higadot l'avincha b'yomahu le'mor, ba'avorzeh asah Hashem li b'tzeisim b'mitzrayim. Now, it's critically important that as we translate these words, we do not lapse into what we think the Pasuk would have said had we not read all the words. Because in our free translation, we would say, tell your son about Yetzias Mitzrayim. But the Pasuk doesn't say, V'higadot l'avincha b'yomahu le'mor, ze asah Hashem li b'tzeisim b'mitzrayim, or Hotziyani b'mitzrayim. The words are ba'avur ze asa Hashem li. Ba'avur means for the sake of. That means that the pasuk itself is telling you not only to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, but also to discuss why. Not only to tell that Hashem took us out, but to discuss why Hashem took us out. What for? And the answer is ba'avur ze. It was for this. And what is this? Of course, Rashi tells us, ba'avur she'akayim mitzvosav, in order to keep the mitzvahs, like Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, as we know, ba'avur ze, lo amarti, and unless those things are in front of us. And so, from that point of view, it seems there's quite a good basis for what Rav is saying in the pasuk itself. Rav is saying, don't just talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Discuss what it was about. Why? What was it coming to treat? Hashem took us closer, right, ba'avur zeh, and the whole of Mitzrayim was necessary because mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayah v'seinu. Not only the events, but also the about the events. So these are a few words on maschilim begnusim, esayim b'shevach, and from there, let us come to refer to the second pillar of Magid, which is the paragraph of Arami Oved Avi. Arami Oved Avi, which is to be found in the Torah in Parshas Kisavo, it is what one says when one brings Bikurim, known as Mikra Bikurim. And again, the Mishnah tells us in Avri Psachim, V'doresh me'arami oved avi. We darshan. And what that means is we take every word, two words, three words, a word or a phrase, and we go back then to the relevant psukim in Chumash Shemos, Kamoshina Emar, and we expand and we elaborate, and that's how we darshan. Interestingly, the Rambam, in his halachas in Mishneh Torah, formats in this vein a well-known statement of us from the Haggadah. The Haggadah says at the end of Avodah Mayinu, V'chol hamar be'lesape b'yitzias Mitzrayim, harei ze mishubach. The more you tell about Yetzias Mitzrayim, the better it is. The Rambam in the halachas, in Hilchos Chametz Matzah, when he discusses the drosha of this paragraph, Arami Oved Avi, concludes and says, V'chol hamarbe bedroshas parsha zo harezim meshubach. That's very interesting. That means for the Rambam, the harezim meshubach, that accolade that goes with the more you say, the better it is, as much as the Haggadah gives us to understand that it's generally about Yetzias Mitzrayim, for the Rambam, it is specifically how you darshan the pasuk of the section of Arami Oved Avi. The more you darshan it, the better it is. And that's an interesting shaila. Why would that, of all sections? I mean, it's an important section. But the designation of Kol Amar B'Harei Zeh Meshubach is specifically tied to that parsha. Within the section, as we mentioned, we take every word and every phrase and we go back to the scene of the crime and Kumoshin Emar and explain it from the relevant psukim. One of the puzzling stages of this parsha is when we get to the pasuk Vayoreu Osanu Hamitzrim Vayanunu. So they were acted evil towards us and they afflicted us, and each of those words, as we said, will be attached to its relevant pasuk. What is the pasuk that amplifies the words Vayoreu Osanu? They were evil to us. It says the Haggadah, Vayoreu Osanu Kemoshine Emar, as it says in Shemos, Havan Ischakmalo. Let's deal wisely with them. Pen yirbeh, lest they increase. Vayaki sekrenam el chama v'nasafka mosaneinu v'nilcham banu v'alam min ha'aretz. Because perhaps, if there's a war, they'll ally themselves with our enemies and they'll wage war with us and then they'll leave or kick us out or whatever the pasuk means. And of course, we have a problem. Because if the words are vayareu osanu, they were evil to us, then the pasuk that we quote in order to elaborate on that should be a pasuk that's describing something evil that they did to us, which it isn't. The pasuk that we adduce is actually a prelude to all of that. It's the things that they thought that we might do to them, if they really thought that. Havan is chakmalo. It's when they're plotting against us, we need to deal wisely with them, maybe they'll overpower us, etc. That's not yet them being evil to us. That's perhaps them thinking that we're being evil to them. But how is that the appropriate pasuk to amplify the words Vayareu Orson? And all of the Mefarshim discuss this question. And Reb Shlomo Kluger, in his Perush, one of his Perushim to Hakodesh HaPesach, gives two explanations, and each one of them, of course, the more illumination we get in terms of this background, the more connected we will be to what was happening there. Firstly, we should note, the words Vayareu Osanu seem to be redundant, even within that parsha, because they're stated generally, they did bad things to us. Well, what bad things did they do? Well, they afflicted us, but that's what the pasuk goes on to say. The very next word is Vayanunu. So the pasuk says explicitly what it only really said generally in the words Vayareu Osanu. And therefore, we should instantly be on guard with regards to these words Vayareu Osanu. What exactly are they communicating to us? Now, when we look at the pasuk Havanis Chakmalo, Paro says, "Let's deal wisely with them." What exactly does he mean by that? What is the wisdom there? Ultimately, he enslaves the Jewish people. I mean, that's evil, but it's not particularly wise. Why is the characteristic introduction here, let's do something very clever? It's very despicable, but where is the chokhmah here? Interestingly, of course, we know that there was a bit of chokhmah in its most notorious sense to get the Jewish people subject to Egypt. As we know, originally, the work was for everyone. And even Paro turned up on day one and started laying bricks. And so did all of the Egyptians. And of course, if all of the Egyptians are turning up, so the Jews are certainly going to turn up, because how could they not be good citizens, loyal citizens? So everyone was in. After a while, the Egyptians stopped turning up. But Jews don't always know when to not be good citizens, especially when the actual citizens are not being good anymore. And they stay, they're always the last ones to be held with these ideals. And we were ensnared in that way. Originally the work was for pay, and it wasn't that bad. But gradually the pay got less and less, and the work got harder and harder. But there was no day that one could say, today is unacceptable. It just became a little bit harder to bear than yesterday. And before we knew it, there's no money and the work is unbearable. The Zohar Kodesh says, comments, when the Pasuk tells us, Vayimaru es chayeyem, the Mitzrayim embittered the lives of the Jewish people, Bavoda kosha, b'chomer uvelveinim. What's chomer? Cement. Says the Zohar, and there's no way we could see this coming. B'chomer means bekal v'chomer. Chomer obviously means kavachom. And then someone else contributes and says, ubegezeira shava. Because as you know, if you read your art scroll Siddur, Rabbi Shmuel's 13 principles, number one is kavachomer, and number two, gezeira shava. And before we know it, we're in the shloshes amidish, atorin adreshes behem. What is the meaning of this? Says the Aruch Laner, Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger, in his introduction to his parish on the Haggadah, what the Zohar Kodesh is saying is what the Medrash just said. Namely, how is it, what made it so bitter for us, the Jewish people, to be enslaved by the Egyptians? Part of the bitterness was that we had been lured into it. That is, that there's a certain pain that comes when a person knows that they were duped into something, even more than if it was forced on them. Originally, the work was easy. So who wouldn't turn up? But then it got harder, and before we knew it, it was too late. Says the Aruch Laner, that's kal v'chomer. Began relatively easy, it got harder and harder. But there's no point that we could stop it. And there's another point. Originally, the decree was for everyone, otherwise known as gezeira shava. It was a decree shaveh. All were equal. All were equal until we ended up being more equal than everybody else by being the only ones who remained. But Kal v'chomer v'gezeira shava, that was part of the chachma, and it's not the last time that the Jewish people have been ensnared by these tactics. But we should also note, coming back to our pasuk, vayareu osanu, if we are medactic, the Meforshim point out that whereas we would be inclined to translate vayareu osanu, they were evil to us, but actually the verb lahariya is lahariya le. It's to be evil to someone, should be with a lamed, not osanu. The pasuk should have said vayareu lanu. They were evil to us, as indeed in Parshas Chukas, when Moshe sends messengers to Sichon or Edom, he says vayareu lanu hamitzriyim. That's the way it should be said. What then is vayareu osanu? And Shlomo Kluger says something that has a terrible ring of truth to it. He explains that the word vayareu here is not necessarily from the word ra, evil, but from the word reya. Vayareu osanu means they made us their reim. Now, what is a reya? It's your friend, it's your fellow, it's your equal, your peer. It's quite interesting, says Shlomo Kluger, that the Egyptians could concoct these things about the Jewish people. They're multiplying at a horrific rate, and they'll take over the country. Why do they think that, as the Jewish people? They never hurt anyone. Why do they think that? The answer, says Shlomo Kluger, is because that's what they would do. If they were multiplying at such a rate and becoming powerful at such a rate, they'd definitely take over whatever country they were in. And if that's what they would do, so it's clear to them that that's what the Jewish people will do, they really believed it. That is to say, because they equated and suspected the Jewish people potentially of doing everything that they would do, so they were sure that we're under threat. But where did it all begin? By your reyu osanu. They made us into their reyim. They understood that we were on an equivalent level to them. In terms of all the things that they would do, that's what we would do. I often think that all of the rumors and stories that circulate about how the Jews are so powerful and they're looking to take over industry and media and the world, and people believe it. And I think part of the reason why is because they can't imagine that we wouldn't, because if only they could, that's what they would do. But they can't, and we can't, so we must. That is to say, it is ascribed to the Jewish people who have the possibility of doing these things, all those things that they would do if only they could. So they are non-practicing insurgents and ascribe it to us. That is yet an emanation of vayareu osanu. There is another important point, difficult point, and this is referred to by the Ramban. Another aspect of why Chochma is needed to enslave the Jewish people. Power, at the end of the day, he is a monarch, as much as he is the king and he can decide. But to induce instability into the region is not something that's good for the monarchy either. So to take a nation and to persecute them in that way, it's not something that is so easy for power to do, for the crown to do, says Ramban. So what's the answer? Paro's original message of alarm is stated in an interesting way. Vayomer el amo. He said to his people, etc. and so forth. The Jewish people, they're multiplying. That's interesting, because when we have in our minds, we picture Paro saying this, we imagine he's saying it to his council of rulers or of advisors. And indeed, there was a stage of that. But the Pasuk doesn't say that. The Pasuk doesn't say Vayomer El Chachamav or El Yoatzav. It says Vayomer El Amo. It sounds like he gave a public address. He said this to the entire nation. Why? The answer, says Ramban, is because Paro wanted this message to get out to the people. Because from a certain point of view, the people could persecute the Jewish people initially in a way that Paro never could. Paro, to a degree, is restricted by the fact that he's the king, but the person on the street is not restricted by anything. And therefore, wave one of persecution was for the message to get out that Jewish people are a threat. No one has any policy yet. But trouble started. And the beauty of this, as far as power is concerned, is none of it could really be, he couldn't be held culpable for it. Because it's a person on the street. And when people come complaining, so his response is, I know, what can you do? We would never sanction something like this, but you know, the people are so hard to control, and they're discontent, and they're rogue factions, and there's nothing really we can do about it. But once the Jewish people had that ground had been broken with them, so then power, in a sense, was much easier for him to continue that work. And, says Shlomo Kluger, that is part of what the Haggadah is saying, Vayoreu Osanu HaMitzrim. If indeed Vayoreu Osanu means they were evil to us, the point is not Vayoreu Osanu Paro. Paro initially would not harm the Jewish people in that way. But the point is he allowed the Mitzrim to do that. But then the obfuscation and the beclouding of the issue made it impossible for him to be culpable for that, and that's how the whole thing started. Vayoreu Osanu HaMitzrim, you know where that idea came from, to let the man on the street do his work for him initially? That was the Havan Yitzchak Malo. That was the Chochmah. That's why he said it to his, to the people in order to release them. And once again, that is a feature of things that was not restricted to that time at all. It was the first, but not the last, of such a policy. So these are the comments of Reb Shlomo Kluger with regards to Vayirei Osanu, one of those difficult, if we study the Haggadah, if we pay attention to the Haggadah, to understand how each phrase comes to be associated with the pasuk that elaborates. So these are some important discussions about that section. The final pillar of Magid that I'd like to speak about this evening is Rabbi Gamliel's three things. Rabbi Gamliel, Haya Omer, if you didn't talk about these three things, you didn't fulfill the obligation. So by the Mishnah's own explicit statement, it is very central and crucial to the mitzvah. Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. We should note, although it is a machlokas, but the Ram comments, and the Ramah quotes it, that as much as Rabbi Gamliel says, if a person did not say these three things, he hadn't fulfilled his obligation, it does not mean that he has not fulfilled his obligation at all. But rather, it means he has not fulfilled his obligation in the optimum way. This is the way it should be done. If he didn't talk about the reasons for Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and explain how these things are physical reminders of either the Vayimaris Chayehem or the leaving Mitzrayim, so he hasn't done the mitzvah min hamuvchar, the ideal way that it should be done, and that is the position of the Ramah. Others argue the position of Tosfos in Sukkah seems to be that he has not fulfilled the obligation at all. But nonetheless, it's certainly a section that full concentration naturally accrues to this part of the Seder. But what's very interesting is, there is a basic question in understanding Rabbi Gamliel's words when he says, if a person did not expound these three things, he has not fulfilled his obligation. Now, the question is, which obligation has he not fulfilled? Well, the simple answer, of course, is, he hasn't fulfilled the mitzvah, telling the story, if you didn't bring in these things and expound them. And how do these things come to be critical? Well, in the Haggadah of the Malbim, he brings us back to the pasuk of Ba'avur Zeh. V'higadot alavincha, once again, is the source for the mitzvah of the evening. And the mitzvah is V'higadot alavincha b'yom olem Ba'avur Zeh. And Ba'avur Zeh means for these mitzvahs. Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. That means the pasuk itself is telling you to talk about the mitzvahs of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, and Rabbi Gamliel explains what needs to expound on those three things. We should know, however, that from the words of Tosfos in Psachim, it seems that he has a different understanding of what Rabbi Gamliel means when he says, Lo yotza yidei chavoso, which chova is lacking. How does it emerge? Well, when the pasuk says, or pardon me, when the Gemara says, you have to talk about these three things, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, the Tosfos asks, why? Where does that derive from? How does it come to be so fundamental? We've mentioned the Malbim, the Haggadah of the Malbim's explanation of Ba'avuzeh, but the Tosfos say something else. The Tosfos say that actually the Pasuk tells you explicitly to talk about the Korban Pesach with the words Va'amartem Zevach Pesach, and moreover tells you, which actually is the answer to Pesach Zeh, is Va'amartem Zevach Pesachu, and the Pasuk told you to talk about it. So that's stage one of the answer. How do we know that it's so important to talk about these three things? It begins with Pesach, and the Torah told you to talk about the Korban Pesach. But what about the other two? Did the Torah tell me to talk about Matzah? Did it tell me to talk about Maror? Says Tosfos, no, not explicitly. But we know that there exists what's called a hekesh, a halachic equation. Because the Matzah and Maror are mentioned together in the Pasuk with Korban Pesach, so the Matzah and Maror are mentioned together with the Korban Pesach, and one of the ways that Halacha is derived is that when things are mentioned together in the Pasuk, they are equated with each other. So now you know, says the Tosfos, that what's true for one is true for all three, because all three are equated. And if you know that you need to talk about Pesach, and Matzah and Maror are equated with Pesach, so now you know you need to talk about Matzah and Maror as well. That is the background to Rabbi Gamliel's three things. V'amartem Zevach Pesach, which then branches out sideways to Matzah and Maror. There's only one problem. And that is that when you have a Hekesh, if we're particular here, when you have a Hekesh that equates things, that means it equates the halachas of those things. That is to say, it's true, Matzah and Maror are equated with Pesach. That means that there are halachas of how to eat the Korban Pesach that are equated to whatever degree they are with Matzah and Maror. But if there's a mitzvah to tell the story of leaving Mitzrayim, which is actually a fourth mitzvah, it's not one of those three. It's its own mitzvah. Tell the story. And part of telling the story is to talk about Korban Pesach. But talking about Korban Pesach is not a halacha of Korban Pesach. It's a halacha of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So now says Marsha, when you come to the Pasuk which equates Matzah and Maror with Pesach, they are equated with Pesach. But what that means is that the halachas of Matzah and Maror are equated with halachas of Pesach. But this isn't a halacha of Pesach. It's a halacha of the Haggadah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. So who's to say that just because the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim demands that you talk about Korban Pesach, that because of the Hekesh it demands that you talk about the other two as well? It doesn't carry through. That's the question of the Marsha. Admittedly, I wouldn't have thought of it. But the conclusion of the Marsha is, amazingly, that it seems, as far as Tosfos is concerned, talking about Korban Pesach is a halacha of eating the Korban Pesach. Once that's true, it is not a halacha of the Haggadah. There is a mitzvah to tell the story, and there's a mitzvah to eat the Korban Pesach. And one needs to talk about the Korban Pesach as part of the mitzvah of eating the Korban Pesach. Ah, once that's true, so then if Matzah and Maror are equated with the Korban Pesach, then the way that you fulfill those mitzvahs is equated with the way you fulfill the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. If you need to talk about the Korban Pesach and expound on it in order to fully fulfill the mitzvah of eating Korban Pesach, and Matzah and Maror are equated, so then we will understand the conclusion that you also need to talk similarly about Matzah and Maror in order to fulfill those mitzvahs. What emerges, it seems, according to Tosfos, is that when Rambam Gamliel says, if you didn't talk about these things, these three things, lo yotze yedei chovoso, it does not mean, as most Mefarshim understand, that you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of telling the story. Lo yotze yedei chovoso means you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. Not fully. Pesach needs V'amartem Zevach Pesach, and Matzah and Maror, because of the Hekesh, likewise. So that is a very interesting discussion with words that one wouldn't imagine that there could be more than one chovosa, that a person isn't yotze, but as we see, that is not the case. But the pashtus remains lo yotze de chovosa of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. And let us come back now to where we started in the beginning with another statement that defines for us Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, Kol Hamarbe Lesaper B'Yetzias Mitzrayim Harezim Shubach. The more you talk about it, the better it is. And Mefarshim raised a question as to why is this said about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it's not said about other mitzvahs. I mean, there's many mitzvahs that one, obviously, if there's an upper limit, then one doesn't exceed it, but there's many mitzvahs that there's a minimum, but the more you do, the better. Kol Hamarbe to give tzedakah, Harezim Meshubach, and Kol Hamarbe in acts of kindness, and Kol Hamarbe to learn Torah, Harezim Meshubach, and we don't find that formulation, but when it comes to Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, Kol Hamarbe Harezim Meshubach. And Rav Shlomo Kluger, again, explains a fundamental principle here as regards to Magid. Why is it Meshubach? Because, says Rav Shlomo Kluger, if one discusses the story at length, it's not just doing more of the mitzvah. It's a different level of the mitzvah entirely. Why? Well, says Rav Kluger, we know that when you tell the story of something that happened a while ago to one of your grandparents or ancestors, you tell the story, whatever needs to be said, and it doesn't necessarily take that long. When a person themselves experiences a miracle, salvation, something special, if it happened to them, how long will they take? How long do you have? They will continue until further notice, until he gives me Guzman Kirishma Shal Shachris. They'll tell you everything, and they'll tell you again, and then someone else comes into the room, they'll start from the beginning. It's the nature of these things. If it's somebody else's story, I'll stick to the facts. If it's my own story, there's no stopping me. So Shlomo Kluger, we know that the way to fulfill the mitzvah on Seder night is Chayev Adam Liros es Atmo Ki'ilu Hu Yotzam Mimitzrayim. One needs to engage in the Seder and become attached to the Seder as if it is us leaving Mitzrayim. How can you tell? Kol Hamarbe Lesaper. If you discuss the story at length, it means you're there. It means it's you. If it takes 10 minutes, it's them. If it takes 3 hours, it's you. Harezim Meshubach, it's a different order of fulfilling the mitzvah entirely. And I came across just this evening in the writings of a contemporary Mechaber, Yitzhak Mirsky, his name has three wonderful volumes, Hegione Halacha, and he brings us back to Aramiya Vedavi, a wonderful insight, because we cannot help but ask, Aramiya Vedavi, it's so much later in the Torah, why is it, and of course, Marbele Saper, so why is it that we don't suggest that the mitzvah of telling the story should take the form of reading the parshas of Shmos, Va'era, Bo, and B'Shalach? You couldn't do better. And we actually access them vicariously, through a klisheni almost. We begin later on, and we go back for the relevant psukim. But why does it take that format? What does the parsha of Aramiya Vedavi have? What does it say that the parshas themselves couldn't say? 100 times better. Says Zemirsky, one thing. It's in the first person. Arami aved avi. Vayareu osanu. Vanitzak el Hashem elokei avoseinu. Vayotzienu Hashem elokeinu misham. All of the parshas of Shemos, Va'era, Bo, V'shalach, for obvious reasons, they describe what happened to the Jewish people. They are the Jewish people. They are our ancestors. But there's something that if we read all of those parshas, we still wouldn't get, because it happened to them. Aramiya Vedavi says it happened to me. And that's why the Rambam says, the more you darshan that parsha, harezeh meshubach, because the more it happened to you, the more meshubach you are, and the more meshubach the mitzvah is. So this, without a doubt, is, as we mentioned, It's an evening of appreciation, it's an evening of hoda'ah, and all of those things are enhanced exponentially. The more we see and connect emotionally and personally, so that on Seder night, when the Jewish people go out of Mitzrayim, we go out with them, and all of that which Yetzias Mitzrayim in its time gave the Jewish people, the more we leave with them, the more it gives us for the rest of the year. I wish you a Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and we'll meet again.